and we'll answer your questions then. All right, to start, my name is David Goldman. This is Robert Murata. We are both with PricewaterhouseCoopers Global Risk Management Solutions Group, specifically security and privacy, focusing on security and control around computing environments. And specifically today, we'll be focusing on privacy regulations and how those affect the way that we do assessment and design and implementation of security controls over computing environments. So the first part we'll talk about is why security, why privacy matters. Why are we having this presentation? Why do we care at all? How is it going to affect the way we go about doing our business? The guys and the framework that we'll be using throughout this is GLEBA, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, and we'll be using that as the top-level overall regulation, and we'll trickle down from there. That'll include the interagency guidelines. And then what we're going to do is basically look at three different scenarios. The first will be an outsourced web hosting environment. The second will be an internal network data flowing within a company. And the third will be data moving beyond the perimeter of a company to third parties and other entities. And what we're going to do is see how we need to look at those in a new light based on privacy regulations. And then we'll just wrap everything up at the end.
We should probably start this conversation off just by talking about why we're even here today. Why are we talking about privacy? And over recent years, consumers have become more and more sensitive to giving out personal information about themselves to any kind of organization that they're looking to buy a product or a service from. And they're worried about what organizations are going to do with this data. They want them to handle their data in a responsible way. So, it's also... We've been, consumers get flooded every day with all kinds of direct marketing campaigns from either snail mail. You get tons of email spam. It seems like it's getting worse over the days. And phone calls. You get those solicitors at night. And people are just not guarding the information that you give them. They're sharing it and selling it. And consumers just really don't want it anymore. So the government's kind of paid a little bit of attention to what's been going on and the consumer desires. And they've come up with a number of new regulations out there at the federal level, things like Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which applies to financial services institutions. And you also have HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability Accountability Act, which applies to companies in the healthcare industry. And then you have a number of emerging state laws that are coming out or out on the horizon. And then there's also a number of pretty important laws out in the European Union as well. Some of the things you have to think about are like the failure to comply with these privacy regulations and why it matters. And right now, as you'll see, the privacy regulations don't really have very strong teeth right now. And we'll talk about, I'm sorry, give me one second. The monetary fines, that's kind of the worst things right now that you have to worry about. And that's probably the most tangible fine that you're going to have out there. Then you have a lot of intangibles as well, which is going to be brand recognition, losing your customer base.
Right. So right now, the basic point is that these acts, as Rob said, don't have a lot of teeth. So the feds aren't going to come in and shut down your business because you didn't conform to some regulation. And as we'll see, right now the regulations, especially at the high level, are very nebulous. And then they get a little more specific as they move down the agency level.
Excuse me.
And then, there's a lot left open for interpretation. So right now, these kind of intangible loss of reputation, customers wanting to go elsewhere, those are the consequences. The compelling force really behind this, though, is that you can really use privacy as a driver for your business. You can say, we have enacted, this is our interpretation of privacy. We're taking these proactive steps, and this is what we've done, so use us.
We're going to go into a little bit about the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. It was enacted in 1999 by President Bill Clinton. The act itself has seven different titles. It's broken up into 740 different sections. And it applies to all financial services institutions that are both regulated and non-regulated. Financial services institutions, the definition for that, you could find in the Bank Holding Act of 1956. What we're really concerned with out of the seven different titles is Title V, which deals with privacy of customer information. So really what you're worried about is kind of the non-public customer information that is collected by organizations, and these regulations kind of they lay down certain prescriptions for protecting that data, regardless of the source or whether or not the actual purchase goes through. So there's a certain distinction that we'll get into later between you have to protect the data of your customers and actually of consumers, which are potential customers, and we'll go into some of those definitions a bit later on. One of the things that's also important is GLEBA is a federal law, and it doesn't preempt stronger state regulations. Just real quickly, a quick overview of Title V and the privacy regulations and what it means. You have to have privacy notices out there. I'm sure about a year ago, everybody was getting all the privacy notices in their mailings. And basically what those were organizations were telling you what they do with the data they collect on you. And they tell you what type of information they're collecting. They also talk about their sharing practices. What these privacy notices are designed to do is inform the consumer that, yes, this information is being collected, and if we are going to share it with organizations that are not affiliated with us, we have to give you, the consumer, an option to opt out of our sharing practices so your information won't be propagated out. Section 501B of the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act is really the one section that has the big effect on the IT operations. And this is it in its entirety. It's not very big. It's actually pretty vague, and there's obviously a lot of room for interpretation on this. And there's really the guidelines out there on what this actually means to IT operations. You can see it's fairly nebulous. We'll kind of go through some of the best practices as we step through the presentation. But it all revolves around two basic concepts. One of them is you have to do a threat assessment. You got to figure out what the risks of this customer data that you collect are. And then you have to take certain steps, different safeguards, or technical, administrative, and physical safeguards to protect the security and confidentiality of the data that you have.
I was just going to say, so basically what the regulations do for us is kind of put a new spin on the way that we go about security. So there's nothing really earth-shattering. There's no new techniques, no new actions necessarily that, you know, from a technical perspective we've never seen before. But what it does is it kind of focuses and adds a couple of things into our practice that that we need to take care of. And, you know, Rob and I will point out the way that those affect the current security assessments that we currently do.
If you look at the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, you have your seven different sections, and again, we're talking just about Title V, which deals with consumer privacy. And the first part of Title V, if you looked at the definition, it basically requires your different regulatory bodies to go out and set their own standards for those entities that they do regulate. So, for instance, you could see the SEC, which is responsible for regulating the banking industry, they've come up with Regulation SP, and that's a final regulation. And it kind of lists out, okay, this is what we think Graham-Leach-Bliley means, and it gives you a little more detail on what to actually look for as far as standards for protecting information. The FTC and the NCUA, they also have very similar final regulations out there. The state insurance companies, there again, they have to come up with their own standards and implementation for complying with Graham-Leach-Bliley. And so far, the only state that's done so is New York State, and they have this New York State Regulation 173, which is their interpretation. The interesting point of this is, you know, you have the potential for 50 different state laws and different interpretations on what a security program should look like. Right now, they're kind of all using the same model, but for those large organizations that do operate in all 50 states and overseas, they might have a number of different requirements they might have to comply with. The one we're going to focus on for pretty much the remainder of the session is the federal banking agencies and the interagency guidelines that they've issued. So far, they're the most complete interpretation as to, you know, what a security program should look like. And you could see that, well, when we step into it, you'll see that they're still pretty vague. I mean, they cover pretty things at a high level. But the whole ruling, it's designed to be like a one-size-fits-all. So there is a lot of interpretation open.
Could you?
Some terms out there that we should kind of get you guys familiar with is this whole notion of non-public personal information and what it means. Some things are, you know, kind of straightforward and things you would guess that you wouldn't be able to gain from public sources, such as salary, social security number, account balances, the type of financial service products that you've bought, so on and so forth. And then you have public information, which can come from a number of public sources, government records, and the like. But things that kind of fall into the gray area are phone numbers. And you can see it's not, you can't just take it for granted that a phone number is going to appear in the white pages and therefore you could share that information without offering the customer an opt-out option. The customer clearly could have an unlisted number. And if they've taken those steps to not publish their phone number, if you did share it with an affiliate, then that could potentially be a violation. You could kind of tick somebody off. So under the rulings, the various rulings, they've come up with a few different definitions as far as what would be considered public information and not public information. And they're all pretty much the same. There's slightly different wording changes. But it comes down to the fact that whoever the company is that's going to do the sharing of information, they have to do a certain amount of due diligence to see if that information was in fact taken off public records.
Right. So basically what this whole thing boils down to, from the Title I, Title V, 501B, through the interagency guidelines that we'll get to in a moment, is this whole notion of the non-public personally identifiable information. So these are, you know, when you go to websites and you fill out form fields, what's happening with that information if it's non-public? You know, if it's your address, a matter of public record, that's one thing. But maybe you're going to buy some financial instruments or apply for some kind of insurance, and you have to enter certain information. So how is that handled? Where does it go? And the basic whole idea is we need to look at that information and how it flows through the entire system. So from capture to storage, movement, archival, everything, we need to follow that data around. And this part with the reasonable basis or the reasonable belief, which are basically the same thing, is basically saying, have the institutions gone to, done their due diligence to make sure that that information is being handled properly? Question?
Assume you have an account list of 500,000 accounts.
Okay.
And you're transferring that data somewhere. That data includes a name, address, and potentially phone number. If you haven't masked that list for unlisted phone numbers, it's pretty much a safe assumption to say that you need to treat that as GLP sensitive, that entire list.
Okay, so the question for everyone that's in here is basically, if you've got some file or some record that has 500,000 accounts or some number of large accounts for many different people, and there's information in there that includes name, address, phone number, and you haven't masked out the unlisted phone numbers, does that entire entity need to be considered information that is covered under GLEPA?
The answer to that is yes. If you have any list made up of mainly public information, but you do have a component of, we'll call it privacy data, rather than saying non-public personal information, then yes, it does have to be fall under those restrictions. So as we talked about, Title V, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley, requires these regulatory bodies to come up with their own interpretations of what a security program should look like. And now we're going to step through the interagency guidelines, which were jointly developed by the four banking regulators, which is the OCC, the FDIC, the Board of the Federal Reserve, and the Office of Thrift Supervision. As you can see, the overall objectives for an IS program is pretty much the same as GLEBA. Do a risk assessment, find out what your threats are, take a look at what your controls are, and specifically look at those controls in light of where the customer data is lying. Your compliance date was roughly a year ago for this, for the federal law. And as we'll step through, you'll see that there is a part of the ruling which requires you to also have provisions within your contracts with service providers to protect any customer data leaving your perimeter and going out to them, either in electronic form or hard copy or whatever type of media it's going out. And you have to have controls over this data as well, but for contracts that were in existence prior to July 1, you do have a 2-year grandfathering clause to get those IT provisions within those contracts as you update them.
So basically at this point we had 501B that was interpreted by all these regulatory bodies, SEC, interagencies, etc. They've come up with these guidelines that have kind of a framework for your IS program, and now you're getting closer and closer to the point where you actually need to do something and implement something and get to something at a technical level. And as we flow through the next few slides, you'll see what those actions we need to start taking on.
Ken, we already talked about this notion of having to assess the risk out there. I found with a lot of the clients that we work on, most people don't really have a good threat assessment process, and it's fairly informal. And most people don't actually take it to the level where they've sat down, thought about all the different internal and external threats, and then really took a hard look at their control environment. And that's kind of one of the first steps you need to do, specifically looking at where your customer data lies. And as we go through the various scenarios, we'll get a little more in depth on that. So you identify your risks. Sir?
When you're doing these, when you're going through and doing an assessment of a client, at what point do you bring in their legal counsel to do it?
Okay. The question was, at what point, we start doing these assessments, at what point do we bring in their legal counsel?
You need some legal review of this law and any current state law which that client interacts in.
Typically, it's a matter of, I mean, most people go to their legal counsel first to figure out what laws they need to be in compliance with so we can tailor our focus. And from the IT side of things, we actually don't interact with the legal counsel all too much. Legal tends to get more involved when you start dealing with the actual development of the privacy notice, making sure it doesn't have too much legalese, and it's, you know, it's pretty straightforward English what it's saying as far as the collection and sharing practices. But it's definitely a good idea to get the legal counsel involved.
That's risk, you're assessing all the technical risks?
Yes, you're looking at the technical environment. Okay. So after you kind of step through the risk assessment process, the regulations require that you have some kind of oversight of the program. And if you're a large company and you have a board of directors, they're the ones who are going to assume ultimate responsibility for the program, although they might not be involved in the day-to-day operations, but there's definitely going to need to be a reporting structure up into them so they're aware that there is a program, it's complete, and it's functioning as intended. Then it's got provisions in there for managing and control risk. So we talked a little bit about this before, designing a IS program that's appropriate for your size and scope of operations. And this is kind of the whole reason why there's not a lot of technical details in the regulations themselves, and it is kind of a one-size-fits-all. Because you can't expect, you know, a smaller company that might operate in one state with, you know, revenues and a few millions to have the same resources, manpower, and technical control environment.
And risk.
And risk as well as, you know, some of your Fortune 500 companies that operate in all 50 states and globally as well. So it is. It does allow for a certain amount of judgment in there. Once you have your IS program in place, part of it is getting the word out there and having a training program. Part of the general privacy laws also stated you have to train your users on, you know, identifying customer data and their role in protecting it, and you have to conduct IS training as well on this. Regularly testing key controls. This is, it's fairly straightforward, but what it comes down to is you can't have the people who actually implement the controls do the testing of it as well. So you can't have your Unix guys go out there and validate the security of their Unix systems, and the same thing for NT and your DBAs. They all have to be independently done. For the companies that aren't large enough to have an audit department, you know, you have to look at how things are set up, and it probably falls into some other type of compliance function. Or you could use third parties to do the controls validation for you. Physical access, that's pretty straightforward. Identify where the data is sitting, make sure it's protected physically. The encryption one's actually kind of interesting. There's been a lot of debate on whether or not customer data needs to be encrypted on the corporate network itself, and also while it's in storage on the corporate network. And a lot of that, again, goes down to how you interpret the privacy laws and what do you think best practices are for you. And it's kind of your business model as well. I guess we'll talk about that a little bit more in the scenarios.
Good question. Yes?
The question was, did that include backups, not dedicated backups, but shared backups? Well, you do have to have controls in place over the data.
I'm talking about encryption of that.
Again, right now, that's something we're just going to have to wait to see how it evolves. Right now, people are focused more on the encryption of data as it flows out of your network. Mainly over...
You would have to mitigate it by other methods if you didn't use encryption.
If you're out, if you're using, you're talking about to a third-party provider.
Yeah.
It's, well, one of the things we'll get into later is that you have to look at the controls in place over that third party. And there certainly are instances where it's going to be too cost prohibitive to implement this. So you definitely can mitigate that risk by looking at their control environment. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later on. But to be quite honest with you, the whole encryption notion is pretty fuzzy for the time being. And it's we'll talk about what the regulators are doing in a second, and maybe that will help answer things a little bit better. Basically, but if not, please ask me again, and we'll address.
Basically, the point is, and you know, you've already seen the actual language in some of these regulations, and there's nothing, you know, there's nothing that says you must use encryption of this strength on data of this type when it's doing this, when it's doing A, B, C, traveling here. So, as Rob said, a lot of this is nebulous right now and is left open for interpretation. And at least in the short term, while technical solutions are either impossible or so difficult, prohibitive, to the point that it no longer becomes reasonable to do that, then, you know, certainly there's not going to be regulatory retaliation for acting in that manner. Good question there first.
Just not really a question, just for say one additional thing.
Sure.
But still thunder law. If it's handled by third party in contract, risk transfer that. Just put in your contract saying you must predict my data when you have.
Right. And the point he was making there is with contracts and legal language you can require them to handle their data in a certain way. And yeah.
I'm the third party that's
I mean, it is.
Make sure the contracts don't have.
Right, from either perspective, right. There's definitely, and we'll get into this later, as far as service level agreements and, you know, SAS 70s and things like that, making sure that they're doing their due diligence rather than requiring a specific type of encryption. Yes.
Just a comment. You made earlier that this was, you were primarily focusing on IT. I just wanted to bring up that you also have to pay attention to the business side of the enterprise, because that's where a lot of your issues will come up, particularly areas like marketing where they're, you know, and I speak somewhat from experience, where you find people that are just glibly sending out lists of names and phone numbers.
Sure.
You know, if people buy a you know, a hat on your website or something, you know, if you get large enough numbers, they ship it out by email. It never touches IT. You never know that it's happening. But it can have the same type of impact if it's ever caught in an audit.
Right.
So you really need to educate and see what's happening from your business process side as well.
That's a great point, following data through the business process. And what we'll talk about later, one of the difficulties, and we'll kind of do this old model, new model thing, but one of the difficult parts of the new focus will be actually finding where your data is and everywhere that it touches. Where does it move? And, you know, the point that was just made was there could be data, you know, that comes from a website, is sent to marketing, wrapped up, sent off in an email. It never really lives on a server or a nice controlled location that IT is in charge of. And that's certainly a control that needs to be evaluated and something put in place. There was another hand. Sure.
Sorry. Since the compliance state has already passed, it's been out about a year, has anybody been
Okay. The question was, the compliance date's already passed. Have people started to been audited on this and reviewed? And if so, what's been the penalty?
Right.
And are they in compliance? And what's, we're going to talk about that in a second. A few more slides up. Just continuing on with the managing and control risk, change control procedures, some of your traditional controls, version control, coders not having access to production, segregation of duties. There's also a provision in there for security monitoring. It talks a lot about the need to have auditing, logging maintained on your different servers wherever there's customer data, and having a good response program in place as well if something weird's going on. You don't need real time. It doesn't say anywhere. You have to have an IDS in place. That's pretty much what the regulation says.
Security monitoring can be looking at your logins.
Right. You could consider failed logins at the application level, at the OS level, network logging. You don't need automated intrusion detection. Again, it goes to the size and scope of operation and what's appropriate, but you do need a way to...
Auditing could be your way of monitoring.
It could be. Part of your auditing is looking for failed logins and abuse of privileges, things like that, or you could have third-party packages on your software as well.
I think the point that you're trying to make, the split, is auditing, everything could just be dumped into logs somewhere, and, if something is raised, then we could go back and follow the trail, whereas the monitoring part of it is, on some routine basis, maybe we need to look at those logs and see if there's anything going on that wasn't, maybe there wasn't catastrophic failure, but somebody's been slowly stealing information or transactions have become corrupted. So there does need to be some type of monitoring, but as Rob said, there doesn't have to be real-time IDS, manned, knock, watching everything that's going on. But in some organizations, that will be the manifestation of this regulation.
Gentlemen in the back.
It's back to an interpretation because it does actually state that you have to be able to detect who has been accessing personally identifiable information, whether it's been updated, who has done it, and when they've done it. It doesn't necessarily, in terms of auditing, it doesn't necessarily determine monitoring because it doesn't say you have to do it, but you have to interpret what you need to do here to accomplish
it.
And I want to say specifically, I believe page 28 or something, the FICC guidelines.
Okay. That's a good point. We talked about a little bit about the oversight of service providers. If you are going to outsource some of your operations and you are going to have this customer data going outside of your network, electronically, physically, you have to do due diligence over the provider before you even choose them if it's after the compliance date. And then periodically you have to do assessments of their control environment as well. And those provisions do have to be captured in your contracts.
And also as a corollary to that, if they in turn outsource again, they must provide you with an assessment of that third party, or you have to go out and do it, or I guess fourth party, however you want to say.
Right.
You have to go do it yourself or receive documentation from that third party. And it's right. Often the case that the smaller third parties don't have the wherewithal to go out and audit the next step. So.
That is correct.
Absolutely. That will come up later.
So. It's a great point. No, it's okay. It's a great point.
Just wrapping things up real quickly, you do have to take a look at your IS program on a periodic basis. Your technology, your processes, your business even could change over time. You have to make sure what you have in place makes sense. And we also talked about the accountability to the board. You got to report to them at least on an annual basis. And here's some of the things you should be coming and talking to them about. Basically letting them know what the status of your IS program is. Is it working? Is it not working? Need more money, more budget, more people?
And the basic point of this is, the way that you go about this is not a static, one-time implementation thing. As with everything in IT, new technologies, new systems, mergers, acquisitions, changes. So there is this annual requirement that things are looked at, and if there's any new systems with privacy data on it, that they're incorporated into this plan and handled appropriately.
So there was a question before about what the regulators are doing out there. We have seen a number of reviews that have passed in the last year, specifically with the OCC, they're really going out there and they're focusing on getting people in compliance, because they know there is a lot of vagueness to the regulations, even with the guidelines that they put together. So their reviews have been focused on taking a look at the privacy statements, focusing on, are you actually doing what you say you're doing in your privacy statements, and then just doing higher level reviews of the IS program in place. For the reviews that I've seen the reports on, if you look at the actual wording of the report, the safety and soundness report, it's actually pretty harsh. And they're sending a pretty clear message that the programs are not up to snuff, or for those that aren't, and there is a bunch of improvement that needs to be made. But the overall safety and soundness rating would come out as a 2, which means you're satisfactory rather than a needs improvement. But the wording itself, it's pretty clear that there are certain things that need to get put in place, and they're going to come back and, you know, do a second review later on in the year. SEC, pretty much their reviews are going the same way. Everybody's focusing on getting people into compliance. And they're looking, spending a lot of time looking at the notices themselves. FTC, I understand, has been looking more at what's going on over the electronic commerce environment.
Okay, so basically, we've gone through GLEBA, we've gone through 501B, the interagency guidelines, the IS requirements, some of the specific details that have been laid out, tasks that have to be undertaken. And that's basically the framework and the model we'll use for the next three little scenarios that we're going to discuss. And here is basically just a reiteration of what privacy data is. And we need to care about who can access that information. What exactly is the information? This gets back to the point that was made earlier, that we don't always necessarily know what that information is. It's, you know, Rob said, you think maybe it is a phone number, maybe it's not a phone number. There are a lot of pieces of information that it needs to be determined whether or not those fall into this. Why is that data critical? When is your regulation effective? Is it past due? You need to get things done right now. Do we have some time? Can we plan things out? And that also goes back to how you were rated this year versus the actions that the regulating bodies are expecting you to take. Where is that information stored and how does it move? Those are really the two critical ones. And we'll see that through the rest of the presentation. It doesn't just, you know, live on a file server, somebody reads it, somebody else updates it, and that's the information. It's moving around, it's dynamic, it goes to a lot of places, and that's really what's going on, which leads us to this old model, new model. In the old model, we had, you know, during a risk assessment, we would say, okay, we have critical data here, payroll data. We have, you know, our secret formula, trade secret. It's stored on this computer, it's encrypted. We use regular operating system and application level access controls to say who can access that, and, you know, that's pretty much how we were looking at things. Now in the new model, we have to basically find the critical data, find the privacy data, and figure out how it flows. So where is it collected? What happens then? A connection back in, sitting on this server, somebody accesses it, now maybe it's on their workstation, maybe they're copying it to a handheld, maybe they're sending it out via email, maybe we're sending it off to any of various third parties that we'll demonstrate later. And it's really a difficult task to figure out where the data is going and to make sure that we do our due diligence to make sure that in every step of the way there are technical controls in place or at least some process controls that ensure that. Question? Well, we do. It's not in this quick sentence, but we actually do, and if you want to look ahead in the slides, we'll talk about all of those. But those levels of authorization was really still, that's kind of the same. Who can access it? Why, you know, what level of access do they have to it? So that really hasn't necessarily changed. It's just the focus of where that occurs is what's changing. Did you want to make that?
No, I think we're actually going to step into that in a few minutes.
So, and as the second bullet says, secure all the network components. that will certainly include your authentication servers, whether they be domain controllers or NIST servers, whatever, what have you. So that'll all be in there. So getting into the life cycle here, basically through the assessment, what is our customer-sensitive information, where does it reside, how does it flow, and then when we get into the design, which is kind of the next step, which is the point you were just getting to, it's where should it be stored, and who should be able to access, and what type of access do they have. And that's, I mean, that's certainly a key critical part of the process. And then from an implementation perspective, we have to do hardware level, operating system, and application access controls to meet those needs. And as was brought up earlier, sometimes from a technological standpoint, it will be too difficult to implement certain things. So maybe we have to look at other things. Maybe we need to look at the application on both ends rather than, you know, the data in transit. Or look at the physical wire and make sure that that's secure. People can't come and tap into that line rather than, you know, saying it's okay for people to tap in the line because the data is encrypted. So look at things, you know, a few different ways. So what we're going to do now is move into these three scenarios that we talked about, and we're going to put up some diagrams. Unfortunately, these are part of the presentation, so they didn't get printed out. But we'll basically put it up. We'll talk through it. We'll move through the scenario. We'll put another one up. We'll move like that. And if at any time you want us to go back to the diagram, just give us the say so. Sure. Yep. It should be on the website, but yes, it will, and we'll make sure that the drawings are included. It should be on the CD as well. It just wasn't in time for the printed bound copy.
If not, if you want to shoot us an email, we'd be more than happy to make sure you get a copy electronically. For the purposes of running through the scenario, we'll go through kind of a fairly typical client organizational setup where the corporate DMZ is run in-house. They use a hosting facility for their web application hosting. And then on their internal network, they have their various business units. You know, some are profit centers, some are internal resources. They have vendor partners out there that they have customer data going out to. You have a remote user force out there, Salesforce with their laptops, which is a concern. And then you also have to worry about the connectivity of any of your satellite offices.
You could talk about it. Sure.
When we start talking about the scenario number one, typical web hosting environment where you have your internet routers going through your primary firewalls, then you have your first DMZ layer. So you've got your load balancers. You have a bunch of different web servers hanging off your switch. And you go through your second set of firewalls for your application servers, and then these are making calls to the back end on the corporate network. So if you can see it up there, the first two boxes, the red and the yellow, you can picture those out at the hosting environment, and then just the green box at the bottom being the backbone of the corporate network. And this is kind of the scenario that we're going to walk through for the next set of concerns.
Okay. So basically our website is outsourced to a third party. They control and manage the web servers. And this web application that we built basically allows our customers, these individuals, to go and update or view policy information. They, you know, cause a transaction. But just as easily, they could be requesting information, putting in privacy data to the website to request, you know, some kind of quote or more information about a product. And the point here is that this is the first entry point of the data into the system, right there from their browser over the internet to our web server. And then, as we saw in the diagram, the third party has connection back into our systems to view, pull, update information, through databases, mainframes, all that stuff. So basically, our concerns. The first thing is, you know, is our site a virtual instance of the web server, or is it its own physical server? And, you know, in a lot of hosting environments, we don't necessarily concern ourselves with this, but if we're virtual instances on the same physical web server, then, you really need to know about the viability and security of other people's applications. Because if someone that has nothing to do with you, they just happen to use the same third-party web hosting, and they're on the same physical server, if they write a poorly coded web application, and that gets compromised, that server is compromised, and now potentially your data is compromised. So, you know, there are web servers out there, a single physical server, that could host 200 different customer applications for different customers. And potentially, you could have to worry about what 199 other separate entities are doing because your data is now on that one server. And in the past, yes, we cared about security, but we were more concerned about, you know, is somebody going to break our application, or is somebody going to be able to break through the ISP's firewall and, you know, get into our back-end network. So that's, you know, it's a new spin on certain things. The second, are we segregated from other customers by VLANs or a separate physical network? So let's say we have our own servers. Now, you know, is there a physical segregation that there would be no way for packets to flow from one of their breached websites to our site? Or is it just, you know, there's some routers, there's some VLANs, and if somebody compromises those routers, then they have access to our site again. So it's not quite the same risk level as the first one, but it's certainly a concern there. And then now we also need to concern ourselves with the third-party web hosting facility themselves. What type of access do they have? What type of monitoring are they doing? Are they just doing pings to make sure that our web server is still alive? Do they have, you know, are they doing full SNMP monitoring? Are they doing other type of remote control management? And, you know, for all intents and purposes, they can have full administrative access to your server, which means they have access to the data while it's on that server. And, you know, they might not legally be allowed to have that.
Yeah, I'd say, just carrying on what David was mentioning, you really have to know the control environment over at the third-party people that are providing whatever service for you, in this instance, your web servers. And you have to look at your method of gaining comfort over their environment. You know, we talked a little bit about SAS 70s and the kind of report it is. The lady over there is shaking her head. SAS 70s, you know, depending on who writes it and who defines the scope, it's not always perfect, and you might not get full comfort over the control environment itself.
So the next part is, what are our technical security concerns? So at the very highest level, the first place that information's coming in, we have the web application layer. You know, and all your web application vulnerabilities, I'm sure you guys have seen the books and been to the other presentations, and there's more tomorrow. Web application hacking is a very hot topic right now. And, you know, from two points, one, if somebody hacks into ours, then we, you know, we could be liable for what happens to any information that they take off that server, or if they spoof our website and start, you know, people are still putting information in, think it's going to the right place, but it's getting siphoned off somewhere else. And then also, potentially, we have to worry about other people's web applications. And this is certainly a place where now we need to almost move privacy back into the development cycle and make sure that those people that are writing these applications think about the information that they're collecting, which loops back into the business requirements, and how they're handling that. Next level down, we have our web server software. So, you know, IIS, PHP, CGI vulnerabilities, ASP vulnerabilities, all of those things at the web server level. A lot of times, people will focus on the bottom two rungs, operating system and network architecture design, but they don't necessarily say, we really need to sit down and look how we're building Apache. We really need to make sure we do all the things with IIS. One of the big problems with IIS a lot of the times was people just left all the script mappings, the default script mappings. And had they gone through the due diligence of saying, all right, all we're running on this site is ASP and HTML, we don't need these 15 other extension mappings, let's remove them, tons of vulnerabilities that affected many, many people wouldn't have occurred. So that layer is often neglected in security. So there's that. Then we move down to the operating system. We have regular issues with Windows and Unix, configurations, services that are running, all of those things. Generally, companies have a pretty good base build, or at least a focus at that level. And then the network architecture and design. as you know, we mentioned from a VLAN or a physical perspective, how are those set up? Not only what traffic is allowed in, but what's allowed back out. Often outbound firewall rules aren't configured very well, especially, say, between the first and second tier. They're just a little too loose. So that's another place we need to concern ourselves with. So that's pretty much the first scenario. Hopefully it was kind of clear a new spin or a new way we need to look at that flow. It'll become much, much clearer why it's more confusing now from this diagram, which will take us through the second and third scenarios. And Rob will go through that right now.
This is just kind of a small snapshot, and it's designed to depict, you know, your data can flow out there in a whole bunch of different areas where you have to look at it, and some places where you may not have, you know, really thought about to begin with. You typically have, you know, let's start from the top up. Somebody in your annuity and pension processing division, if you're a life or insurance company, they're going to have a workstation with a standard build on it. They're going to have their own set of applications. Typically, they're going to lock into some kind of domain. Most of the times now, you see some kind of Windows authenticating at the network level. They're probably going to have storage of data out on a file server someplace where they may or may not be the only group that has access to it. They're probably going to store stuff locally on their workstation. They're going to be printing stuff out in hard copy. You have to worry about those type of controls you have in place. A lot of people are going to put customer lists out on their Palm Pilots. You know, they have customer data that's pretty mobile. And they're going to be using probably some kind of front-end processing, either a Unix machine, like we have depicted here, it could be NT, whatever your in-house application is running on. And that could be writing out to a database someplace. And here we have it listed as a Sybase database. And the front-end processor is going to pump information through to a back-end mainframe that's going to do, you know, the back-end, back-office processing for it. Then you might have, you know, your customers calling in to some kind of voice response unit where they're, you know, either changing their account balances or shifting funds, something like that, through the telephone. That could be running on a mainframe. That could be interacting with your other mainframe. And then you have to look at your storage on the mainframe itself. You could have DB2 out there. It's pretty typical. Sometimes you might just have flat files. And then this information that's being stored out there is somehow probably getting transmitted out to some kind of statement printing company. You see, that's pretty typical. Most people don't print their statements in-house. They ship it off to a vendor and let them do it. That's got all data that needs to be protected, and now it's leaving your borders, and you have to worry about it. Then working on the sort of at the bottom of the diagram, it's a pretty typical scenario, again, for a broker-dealer type environment, and it's the same situation. You have a standard build. You have your data laying out on a few different places, different databases that are getting written to. Your mainframes, doing your processing. And now you have to start dealing with other data leading to other types of business partners, either your clearing corporations, people handling the settlement process for you. And, you know, in certain instances, any information or processing that's being updated on the mainframe is going to a master customer file someplace, which is your central repository that your sales force could be accessing, and typically they're going to be remote users dialing in to get this information when they're going through the sales process with either new clients or prospective clients.
Right. So basically the point here is that data is in a lot of places at a lot of different times. And, you know, through the next couple scenarios, we'll basically show that it's not always easy to figure out where it is and what we need to focus on.
Before you move on, kind of going to the middle of the slide, you know, here's where your IT group sits. If you're a big shop, a global company, you might have a set of Unix admins, NT admins, you might have database administrators, and they may or may not need access to you know, the systems that all this customer data resides on. And there was a question before about who has access to the data. So some of it is through your business applications and your traditional rules and profiles of what your users can do and the people in the business units. Then you have to look at your IT shop as well. And if you're a large company with pretty big operations, you're probably going to be held to a pretty high standard as far as what your IS organization should look like. And then you might get into the argument of where encryption is needed. For the databases, depending on what your business model is, you may have to encrypt certain rows in your database where the customer data is residing. Again, it kind of goes down to your business model and how your developers and your maintenance people are aligned with the business units, if they are, or just a big shop that has access to all your different processing environments.
It's very non-trivial on large databases.
Exactly. But if your business model is, well, this database, you know, my, you know, all the people focusing on the life stuff, you know, I have certain developers and database people and Unix admins focusing on just that stuff, you could say, okay, they're aligned with that business unit and only that business unit, so they don't have an excessive amount of access. So part of it does go to your business operations.
Okay. So basically scenario two is our internal data flow. Rob covered most of this already, but basically the customer data is in a lot of different places, flowing around the network, touches a lot of different applications, a lot of different systems, and it's often printed to hard copy for review, analysis, archiving purposes. And as we get through and see the concerns, the first thing we might care about is our actual authentication. So if we're authenticating to get access to certain systems and those systems are housing or administering and have access to critical information, then, you know, maybe we need to start looking at stronger types of authentication. So the second thing is, you know, cross-platform. So we've got Unix servers, we've got Windows servers, we've got various other systems. And one of the things we might want to do is set up, you know, single sign-on so that we can track a little better who has access to all the various systems by centralizing our authentication. And the flip side of that is, the flip side of that is if you centralize your authentication, you may be creating a single point of failure where if that becomes breached, then somebody's basically got the keys to the kingdom and they can run around and do a lot of different things. So, you know, there's the good and bad to doing everything. It's basically what's right for size and scope of your organization and what makes sense to protect the data that you're protecting. The last point here on authorization and access control is your inner operating system communication. Maybe you've got, you know, on a Windows system, you've got a batch job that runs that kicks off a FTP session to VMS to shoot some data up there. So that data that's traveling, the login to the VMS system could be in clear text. The data traveling could be in clear text. Do we need a better solution? And the first part of that may be just to use something that uses secure credentials, then maybe creates a secure and encrypted tunnel, which gets back to a bunch of what we were talking about earlier. For internal network communication, do we need to go to that level? And maybe, maybe not. We need to determine. And then the last part of this is really the communication paths, and that's how do we really know where network where the data is flowing? And this may get to the point where we really need to go to a deep technical level and really look at the network and snip and watch packets and see what protocols are bound to ports to look around and really say, all right, here's data. If we're just moving, you know, if we've got our servers and our clients and they're sitting on a single subnet and we're protected from other subnets with, you know, firewall rules and things, well, that makes it very easy to control who has access to that small area. But if, you know, going through that process from a mainframe to a front-end processor to a client server app to a workstation, and that goes, you know, from New York to Chicago to San Francisco to Asia and back, and that data basically covers the globe, some of the lines, you know, may not even be lines that you own entirely. They can be shared lines with other people, and we really need to, you know, make sure that we consider all of those communication paths that data is traveling, even internally. Once we get to external perspective, it even gets more confusing. Question in the back. So the question basically is how much stress is there really going to be from a regulatory perspective to say to you, do you know where your data is at all times, and have you considered, you know, all of those points? That's basically the question. Yes.
Well, the question is how much we need to bring together. I think
part of that is going to go back to the size and scope of your operations. If it's a smaller shop, small business, you know, single state, I think the level of detail that they're going to be held to doing is probably going to be a bit less. You're definitely going to need to go in and be able to document what you looked at and how much you understand over the provider's control environment. Some of the larger corporations, I think they're going to be held to a much higher standard in being able to, you know, really get a handle of what the environment that their data is sitting in looks like. As far as how detailed the regulators are going to go, it's kind of up in the air right now. It's that hasn't really been something that they've addressed, and they haven't really given any indication as to, you know, what the nth degree of detail you need to go into over your service providers.
And it also goes back to the point earlier of what are the repercussions, and some of those repercussions are, you know, the intangibles, but reputation, loss of customers, things like that. And, you know, it's kind of left up for you to determine whether or not that's critical enough to be covered. Question.
The question was, do telephone and fax communications, are they covered as well? The answer is yes, they are. Any kind of, it doesn't matter the type of media, how the data exists. It could be sitting down in hard copy, it could be electronically sent. You have to have controls over it. If you have, when you're talking about the fax machine example, a lot of that is kind of probably rely on the security controls or the physical security controls that you have in your environment. Are they reasonable enough for what you have? You know, if you're, again, a small shop, you probably don't need key card access that's periodically being reviewed or things like that. If you're a larger organization.
And unless you're using cryptic faxes that authenticate to each other, you can't guarantee that, you know, Joe, the summary return will fax that back to customer data to the local news channel instead of to...
Absolutely, and you know, some of the things just can't be technical controls. They have to be, you know, process and other non-tangible controls. Basically just here, you know, our printer secured is paper. Paper is just as important, which gets back to fax, phone call, same thing. Just because it's on a piece of paper and it's physically hard copy now, it's still the same data. And we need to worry about, you know, sending it in our office, sitting it on a desk. You know, potentially the cleaning staff has access to all the files that are sitting out. Anything that was left sitting in a printer, anything that was left sitting in a fax machine. So... And then our third scenario, which is where it manages to get even more complex, is in dealing with third parties and data leaving your perimeter, leaving for printing, leaving for backup, leaving for other archival, leaving just for, you know,
know, access and business relationships with other people where you're exchanging data. The first one here is also a unique situation. If you have independent field reps that deal with your data, but they also deal with the data of several other companies, you don't have control over the build of their laptop. You don't have control over whether or not they have a personal firewall. You don't have control over whether, you know, they can, it would be possible for them to send data or manipulate data incorrectly between your network and somebody else's network. And then the last point that is often overlooked is when a lease expires on hardware, what happens to the data that was sitting on those drives? Is it truly wiped to the point where even a forensics analysis with Encase or something couldn't get it back? Most of the time, that doesn't happen. And there have been some, you know, some high-profile situations, at least, you know, in New York State, where you go to a government auction, buy 100 laptops for, you know, $500, and they still had the data on them, easily accessible. So, you know, we certainly have several concerns about configuration, our dial-up lines, how we're distributing tokens, who has access to them, how do we recover them afterwards, what do third parties do with their network connection? Maybe you're saying, well, they only need, you know, they're only coming in to run this batch job. But the fact of the matter is they now have an account on your network. They have a line into your network. There are firewall rules that at least let some information back and forth. What are they really doing with that? How are the routers and firewalls configured? And then I think we've certainly talked about the last part here, how is data handled once it leaves our network? And then the point that was brought up earlier about their third-party connections, you know, which now a fourth party to you, a lot of people don't think about that, but what happens with them? What if they're subcontracting? What if they have business partner relationships? And, you know, somewhere umpteen relationships down the line, somebody can still get back into that network and potentially see that information. And it requires, you know, we have SAS 70 up there. We've talked about shortcomings of that. There are a lot of other service level agreements and contractual things and things that the lawyers need to do to make sure that, you know, proper CYA is performed. And as we only have a couple of minutes left, we will leave the key points. We basically have three slides that follow that summarize what we've said. But to wrap it up in 30 seconds, everything right now is very vague. There are overall requirements that expect a lot of IS organizations, and there are not clear definitions on how you're supposed to go about doing them. So hopefully what we've kind of presented to you is at least a framework that leads to at least a new model that you can use to analyze data in a new way and raise some awareness about what needs to be focused on and what you need to concern yourself with, and potentially what activities need to be added to an annual audit as far as making sure new information is, this type of new information is included as part of that audit. And that's that. Thank you very much. And I do need to make one announcement. The hacker court will be in Palace Number 3, not Palace Number 1. Okay.